This is the last day of this December 2007 four-day session. And today we'll take up a koan for investigation. This is from the Blue Cliff Record, number 80. Zhao Zhou's A Newborn Baby. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, Zhao Zhou is Joshu, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Zhao Zhou said, It's like a ball bouncing on swift flowing water. The monk later asked Tosu, what is the meaning of a ball bouncing on swift flowing water? Tosu said, moment by moment it flows on without stopping. Let's read a little bit about Zhao Zhou, some of his sayings. I won't try to sketch out his life. We do that periodically, but not today. But here are some of his sayings. A monk asked, well, let me just say this much, that he's maybe one of the half dozen most famous of all the Chinese Chan masters in their whole history. He figures in more koans than any other master. He had his first opening, his first kensho when he was 18. Reportedly reached full enlightenment when he was 56, but didn't begin teaching until he was 80. And then he taught for 40 years until he died at 120. He's known for his amazing gift with words. They said at the time that when Zhao Zhou spoke, he emitted light from his lips. First, a monk asked him, what is the principal concern of the one wearing Buddhist robes? Zhao Zhou said, not to deceive himself. I love this one. It covers so much. It's such a great teaching. Not to deceive ourselves. The mind is so wily, so cunning. There's so many ways that we're in denial. We're unaware of what's really happening, what we're really doing, our motives, our intentions, our shortcomings, the ways that the mind tries to dress up what we're doing, what we're saying. Through Zazen, as everyone knows who's done it long enough, through Zazen we come to see through these deceptions of the mind. This is essential, absolutely essential for becoming, in order to become a full, whole, aware human being. We have to see through these self-deceptions. And they seem to stretch on endlessly. you go through a bunch of them, you start seeing all of the devious ways that the ego works, perpetuate this fiction that we're fundamentally different from other people. We're special. We're special either being better than other people or worse than other people, superior or inferior. So we have some insights into that mechanism and the different veils that we have obscuring the mind, obscuring our nature. But then I can say for one who's practiced a long time, you just keep running into new ones, more and more subtle, but still there. And Zhao Zhou goes right to that point in his simple answer. The principal concern, not to deceive yourself. A monk asked him, "I am a stupid person, floating, sinking, floating, sinking. How can I be released from the suffering of this world?" Zhao Zhou just kept sitting silently. The monk said, "Master, am I not sitting here appealing to you?" Zhao Zhou said, "Where on earth is it that you are floating and sinking?" Can suppose that this monk is quite captivated by his own image of himself, buffeted about, rising and sinking in the sea of samsara. There's an element of melodrama to this question. But he asks, "How can I be released?" And Zhao Zhou responds by sitting silently there. There's your answer, monk. But it goes over his head. He appeals again. "Hey, look, give me something. Throw me a bone here. Where on earth is it that you are floating and sinking?" I remember going to Doksan after a few years of practice and just appalled at how clogged my mind was with concepts and thoughts. And I said to Roshi, I can't believe how clogged my mind is. And he didn't even look up. He was looking at something else. He said, "Your mind is no different from anyone else's, Peter's." He was right. I'm still trying to tell people the same thing in Doksan. Everyone thinks that their mind is, they're so out of control, there's all these special, unique problems. You ought to be in the teacher's mat for a while. You hear pretty much the same thing all the time. And it's the same thing that I know through my personal experience. A monk asked, "What is the ultimate word?" Zhao Zhou coughed. The monk said, "That's it, isn't it?" Zhao Zhou said, "Alas, they won't even let me cough." Yeah, that's enough for today. Now about this other guy, Tosu, his Chinese name is... Tozu. So the Japanese made it Tosu. So this is Tozu Da Tong. He was he lived in the great Tang Dynasty, like most of these characters in the koans. His years were 819 to 914. There's some names here that are mentioned. I'm reading from now from Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. If anyone wants to have a source of biographical material about the great Chinese masters, this is it. There's nothing that can compare to it. Zen's Chinese Heritage, Andy Ferguson. He left home as a young man. He studied meditation techniques of the Anapana Sutra. I'm not familiar with that one. Sometime later, he read the Flower Garland Sutra and went to another master and came to enlightenment under him. And then he roamed through China, eventually returning to his old home and settling on Mount Tozi. The masters often took the name of the mountain that they were on. There he built a thatched hut and remained obscure for more than 30 years. Tosu's eminence as a Zen adept could not be concealed, and the great Zhao Zhou came looking for him. And here's where we pick up with a dialogue. These are translations from the original material found in ancient scrolls or on steles, monuments of one kind or another. One day, Zhao Zhou came to Dongcheng County, which is near Mount Tosu. Tosu left the mountain. They met each other on the road. Sounds like high noon. Zhao Zhou asked him, "Aren't you the host of Mount Tosu?" And Tosu acted like a beggar, and he said, "Tea? Salt? A coin? Please help me." Zhao Zhou then proceeded to Tosu's hut on the mountain and sat down inside. Later, Tosu returned to the hut carrying a jug of oil. Zhao Zhou said, "Long have I heard of Tosu, but since coming here, all I've seen is an old-timer selling oil." Tosu said, "You've only seen an old-timer selling oil, but you haven't recognized Tosu." Zhao Zhou said, "What is Tosu?" Tosu lifted up the jug of oil and yelled, "Oil! Oil!" Zhao Zhou asked, "What do you say about the one who undergoes the great death and thus attains life?" This, by the way, is another koan in the Blue Cliff Record. It's the one right before this one. It's number 79. Tosu said, "He can't make the journey at night. He must arrive in the daylight." It's a difficult koan. Zhao Zhou said, "I've long committed thievery, but you're worse than me." This is a part of the colloquial Zen colloquial use is referring to someone as in praise. You refer to someone as a thief, a master teacher as a thief, because they've taken away your obstructions, your defilements. It's a good reminder that there's nothing we need to acquire in practice. It's this whole thing, everything we do in practice is for the purpose of getting rid of what is not essential to us. Not just what's not essential to us, but because it's not essential, that which obscures our essential nature, that which gets in the way of our harmonious functioning in the world. And then an anecdote. One day, this Tosu, Master Tosu, entered the hall and addressed the monks, saying, "All of you come here searching for some new words and phrases. collecting brilliant things which you intend to stick in your own mouth and repeat. But this old monk's energy is failing, and my lips and tongue are blundering. I don't have any idle talk to give you. If you ask me, then, I will answer you directly, but there is no mystery that can be compared to you yourself. I won't teach you some method to collect wisdom. Again, the danger of collecting anything we want to get rid of. I remember my saying earlier this session about what I would want most from people after Taisho is to forget everything I've said. I won't teach you some method to collect wisdom. I will never say that above or below there's a Buddha, a Dharma, something ordinary or something sacred, or that you will find it by sitting with your legs crossed. You all manifest a thousand things. It is the understandings that arise from your own life that you must carry into the future, reaping what you sow. I have nothing to give you here, neither overtly nor by inference. I can only speak to all of you in this manner. If you have doubts, then question me. A monk asked, when it is not received overtly or by inference, then what? Tosu said, are you trying to collect wisdom? Tosu then left the hall. There were apparently periods in Chinese history where many of these monks, who didn't always become ordained for the purest reasons, would make it their business to collect sayings of the masters and then spout them to other monks to impress them. Now, we can see from reading Zen texts that the masters have always quoted their predecessors at times. But this apparently, evidently, became a real attachment by many monks, where they were just trotting out their learning. And so it's not only Tosu, but other masters we read about who inveigh against this habit, this practice. A monk asked, what about when the golden manacles are not open? Apparently this is a reference to, you know, the source of wisdom, our original wisdom. How about when the golden manacles are not open? Tosu said, they are open. Wide open. We open them every time we inhale and exhale. Every time we swallow. A monk asked, one Dharma universally freshens all beings. What Dharma is this? Tosu said, the falling rain. A monk asked, who is the master's teacher? Tosu said, if you look from in front of him, you can't see his head. If you look from behind him, you can't see his back. And then finally, Master Tosu resided on Mount Tosu for more than 30 years. Those who came for his instruction often overflowed the hall. The master spoke in an unimposing manner, answering all questions, aiding each person's development and expressing great meaning with few words. The Huang Chao bandit uprising broke out during the Zhong He era around the year 883. At that time, every place experienced disaster and chaos. Once, a crazed bandit brandished a knife at the master and said, "What are you doing living here?" Tosu calmly continued to teach the Dharma. When he finished speaking, the bandit bowed and took off his own clothes to leave as an offering. And then on the sixth day of the fourth month in the year 914, the master became slightly ill. The monks called for a doctor. Tosu said to the congregation, "The four great activities of life ebb and flow unceasingly. You mustn't be concerned. I can take care of myself." After saying these words, the master sat in a cross-legged position and passed away. Well, that's all the material we have on these two fellows. And now we'll go back to the case. A monk asked Zhao Zhou, "Does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not?" First, what are these six senses? This is basic Buddhist psychology. You can read it in every different Buddhist school. The five senses are the ones we also acknowledge as the five senses. And then the sixth is thinking. This is considered a sense of a sort, like the other five. And these six senses, sometimes they're called six consciousnesses, then are followed by the seventh level of consciousness, which interprets the data of the senses. That is what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think about, then gets conveyed. The seventh level is called the conveyor consciousness. And all that stuff, all that data, gets conveyed to the eighth level, which is the level of the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. According to this understanding of the way human consciousness works, everything we hear, see, smell, taste, touch, and conceive of, think about, is filed away. It's dumped. It's in this storehouse consciousness as a seed, as seeds. And this is the mechanics of karma. This gets us to this very, very important and rich word, Japanese word nen, which is virtually impossible to translate. There was the translator and assistant to the Roshi of one of the temples I trained at in Japan once came to me and said, "How do you," she's American, "how do you translate nen?" And I was at a loss, as she was, but we can try with a few words. There's what we call the first nen, the second nen, the third nen, and subsequent nen. The first nen is the direct perception, the direct activity of these six senses: the thought, the sound, the sight, the taste, the feel, the smell. Just that, directly. Sound of the train. There it is. Mm-hmm. just that. The second then would be then to make something of that, to have a thought about the train. It's once removed now. Or to have an association of the train, to have a memory of a train. The second nan, this all happens in like nanoseconds. The third nan is another one, another thought about that thought. And then the fourth, fifth, and so forth, these all pile on and form a train of thoughts, or nen. I guess the shortest translation of nen, though still inadequate, is thought or thought moment. I've heard it translated that way. When we say in the Kanongyo, this moment arises from mind, this moment itself is mind, that's nen. The original is nen nen ju shin ki, nen nen fu ri shin. This thought moment, we used to translate it as this thought arises from mind, this thought itself is mind. Both of them are unsatisfying. And then this seventh level, this is the core sense of a separate self. This is where this is the seat of the ego, the sense of a separate entity. Then this takes this data, and again it deposits it in this eighth level of the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. And there it lies as a seed, a karmic seed that's been sown, that then under the certain causes and conditions will then sprout into an action or a reaction. That's what karma literally means, action or reaction. So this points to how important it is at how we use our senses. What we look at, what movies we see, what images go into our mind, what we read, what we listen to on the radio, music, what we expose ourselves to with touch, what we smell, what we taste, what we eat, all of these things, and what we think about, the way we use this mind, this human mind. The intellect, because these things determine our karma, our future. It's all going into the storehouse consciousness, where it's just in this latent form, this dormant form, where it will then emerge again as the effects of all this operation of the senses and the intellect. So when the monk asks him, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Well, we know that they kind of do. I'm no expert on newborn babies, but I have read that their sense of sight is not, they can't quite focus when they're first born. And who knows? I mean, how much can anyone know about the experience of a newborn baby? Certainly the senses don't seem to be fully developed. And then there's the mind, the intellect. A baby, a newborn baby, does not have a developed sense of self, of course. It hasn't developed self-consciousness. But we can presume that it is, since it does have some operation of the ordinary five senses, the seeing and hearing, and it does respond to sounds and somewhat to sight, that also its intellect is not completely blank. There's, well, we know this because that's, this is where, as soon as it's born, a baby, we start learning. The brain is just sucking up all of this data and developing the capacity to learn, and then eventually to speak, and so forth. So it's a human being, a newborn baby, but not a developed one. This monk is no beginner. He's raising a very intriguing question. Is a newborn baby, does it have a human faculties? We know it has the equipment. It's got the eyes, ears, nose, and so forth, and the brain. But that equipment has to be fully wired. It's got the hardware, maybe, but not all the software all yet. I'm getting in over my head here. You can take it up with me after, Zixin. So Zhao Zhou's answer is still reverberating down from the centuries. It's like a ball bouncing on swift flowing water. The monk later asked Tosu. Later. So this was working on him. Zhao Zhou's answer didn't catch him in a way that he could appreciate it, understand it. So later, we don't know, a month later, a year later, 5 years later, he asked Tosu, what is the meaning of a ball bouncing on swift-flowing water? Tosu said, moment by moment, it flows on without stopping. Awareness flowing on, but self-awareness, not so much. I'm going to read here from a commentary on this koan by Yuan Wu, one of the co-authors of the Blue Cliff Record. Very briefly, an earlier master, Shui Do, compiled these 100 cases, stories, dialogues, anecdotes. He compiled them, put them in a collection, put them in a bunch of scrolls, and then like 60 years later, this other guy, Yuan Wu, published them. He had them printed, and he added his own commentaries. And this is his commentary about this koan. Although a newborn baby is equipped with the six consciousnesses, though his eyes can see and his ears can hear, he doesn't yet discriminate among the six sense objects. At this time, he knows nothing of good and evil, long and short, right and wrong, or gain and loss. A person who studies, who practices the path, must become again like an infant. Then praise and blame, success and fame, unfavorable circumstances and favorable circumstances, none of these can move him. And then he quotes someone else. Though his eyes see form, he is the same as a blind man. Though his ears hear sound, he is the same as a deaf man. That's the end of the quote. And then Yuan Wu continues. He is like a fool, like an idiot. His mind is motionless as Mount Sumeru. This is the place where patch-robed monks really and truly acquire power. He's speaking here, of course, about samadhi. Getting beyond the realm of discrimination, beyond thoughts, concepts, words. In this realm, we are not depositing seeds of karma in the storehouse consciousness. In fact, Hakuin, in the Hakuin chant, says, one true samadhi extinguishes evil. It purifies karma, dissolving obstructions. When Yuan Wu here says that we need to become again like an infant, of course, he means in that sense, an infant has to be socialized and educated and civilized. And that happens through learning to discriminate. We need to discriminate all the time. We're always discriminating. People who can't discriminate are psychotic. So that's an ability that comes with the development of human development, the development of the brain and the whole socialization process. We learn to distinguish this from that, right from wrong, what's proper, what's improper, what's harmful and what's not harmful. But we all have that. Everyone here. I'm pretty sure everyone has that. It's a joke. Don't make anything of that. You know, you never know. Someone can hear something like that and start brooding about that. Is he referring to me? Am I that bad? We all have this. We got all the equipment. It's all up and running. Just fine. Now that it's all running, we're not going to lose that. We're not going to lose the ability to discriminate. We're not going to lose our sense of what's harmful and what's not harmful in our actions. We know right from wrong at a gut level. We've embodied it. But what we need to lose is this incessant, unnecessary discriminating and judging, evaluating, categorizing, classifying when it's unnecessary. Sometimes it's necessary. Often it's not. The mind just churns away, discriminating, discriminating, discriminating all the time when it's not necessary. And as a result, we become separated from our life. Our direct experience with the senses, these incredible gifts of seeing, hearing, smelling, and so forth, and thought, we become separated from these things that become mediated. The mind grays, and we find ourselves in the state of dissatisfaction, dukkha, and having to come to Sesshin. Yuan Wu continues here. He quotes an ancient. They often don't quote these old masters by name. I suspect it's because once you get to a certain age, you don't remember who said what. You know, an ancient said, "My patched garment covering my head, myriad concerns cease. At this time, I don't understand anything at all." It means without understanding anything up in the intellect. It's not having thoughts about. And then Yuan Wu comments on that statement. Only if you can be like this will you have a small share of attainment. Though an adept is like this, nevertheless, he can't be fooled at all. as before, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. He is without artifice and without clinging thoughts. He is like the sun and moon moving through the sky without ever stopping. Without ever stopping. Moment by moment, it flows on without stopping. This phrase, he is without artifice. This is a quality that is you often see in people with long training, a kind of childlike quality, a lack of deviousness, disingenuousness. Ingenuousness. And then a later master, Master Shan Tao of the Stone Grotto, spoke to his monks about this response of Tosu, or Joshu, both. Haven't you seen a little one when it's just emerged from the womb? Has a baby ever said, I know how to read the scriptures? At that time, it does not know the meaning of having the Buddha nature or not having the Buddha nature. As he grows up, he learns all sorts of knowledge. Then he comes forth saying, I am able and I understand, without knowing that this is troubling over illusory dusts. Among the 16 meditation practices, the baby's practice is the best. When he's babbling, he symbolizes the person practicing the path with his detachment from the discriminating mind that grasps and rejects. That grasps and rejects. Right, cuts right to the heart of it. It is this habit of our liking and disliking as we chant in the Affirming Faith in Mind. The great way is not difficult for those who do not pick and choose. When preferences are cast aside. Newborn babies haven't fallen yet into likes and dislikes. Yes, there's a response to just basic physical response when it's too warm, too cold, when it has to poop. But it doesn't do this thinking about what I wish it would be like. Why can't it be like this? Why does it have to be like this? I would prefer that. I don't like that. I can't it be this way? This is the source of our misery. We do this to ourselves out of habit. We've been doing it for lifetimes. It keeps running on its own power, because of all these seeds that we plant. What Zazen offers is a way to live with the immediacy of a newborn baby, the simplicity, ultimately, or in degrees. We move in that direction, let's put it that way, where we see things simply, we respond simply. We don't indulge in hypothetical things, and we don't find fault with what is this. We don't find fault with people to the same extent through practice. We don't find fault with ourselves. Less and less as we go on. Because every time we conceive of a self, every time we think about, judge ourselves, think about ourselves, in any way, finding fault or praising ourselves, then we are stepping out of the stream, this stream of life, of movement, of flux that is reality. Every time we do that, we are separating ourselves. We are missing this rich, unfathomably wonderful present moment. All right, our time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.